Welcome to the Modern Girl Podcast. I'm your host, Caitlin Parsons. I'm a certified holistic health coach, intuitive eating specialist, and health at every size advocate. Cozy up with me each week for empowering conversations with ambitious women as we share real stories around our relationships with food, body, and moving through life in the modern world. Hello! Welcome to the show. I'm in a great mood because it's springtime, and it was my birthday this week. I'm actually not that big of a birthday person. I'm not sure if you feel the same way. I have quite a few friends who love birthdays and I love loving on their birthdays. But for me, it's one of those days where I like to just keep it really chill and fun and grounding. And I had a solo birthday and I also spent time with friends the week before, and my husband and I had a really nice time together, but I felt very loved. And I love birthdays because it's a really intentional moment in life to reflect and get excited about all of the things coming up, and also just anchor into gratitude. And that was my intention for this birthday. I went to the beach. I journaled on the beach. I read a magazine. I threw a mask on and went shopping at Anthropology. I made dinner with my hubby, like I said, and just chilled. And it was super fun. So anyways, that's a little insight into my previous week, but this is not about me. This is about my guest, who is absolutely fantastic. I have Emma Townsend on the show today, all the way from the UK. Emma is a UK registered dietitian and a certified intuitive eating counselor. She acknowledges the complex nature of health and the equal importance of both physical and mental well-being. She works with women to overcome a stressful relationship with food and body to find freedom in life. You're going to love her. She is so incredibly sweet and sincere and full of knowledge. I so appreciate her transparency in this conversation. We talk all about Emma's personal body image story, of course. We talk about the fear of taking up space and also disordered eating in dietetics and nutrition programs. We also get into practical tips on creating more diversity in the dietitian space, as well as Emma's experiences of thin privilege and the stereotype that exists for dietitians. Love this conversation so much, and I have a feeling that you're going to as well. You can click the show notes and connect with our guest, Emma Townsend, today, as well as grab hold of all of the things that we have going on in our community. I am so grateful for you, and I am wishing you such a great week ahead. And without further ado, here is our guest, Emma Townsend. Emma Townsend, hi. It's so nice to talk to you all the way in London, too. This is so cool. How are you?
Yeah, I'm really good, thanks. Thanks for having me. It's my pleasure.
Oh my God. Thank you so much for being here. I am so excited to have this conversation with you. And like we just said, my best friend in the entire world lives in London. And so as soon as I saw that that's where you were calling in from, I got super excited. So thanks for being with us, and let's just dive on in because there's so many things that I want to ask you and just things that I can see in this conversation coming up. So let's do it. You ready?
Yeah, already.
Okay. So the first question that we ask everyone is your first body awareness moment. So if you could share what that looked like for yourself, that moment that you realized I'm in a body and this means something in the world that I'm living in. And also how that shaped your relationship with your body and food, if at all.
Yeah, definitely. So I grew up with a lot of body privilege, especially thin privilege. And that definitely shaped how I viewed my body. And when I've been unpacking over the last couple of years since learning about intuitive eating and studying that, there's two kind of shifts that I noticed from my childhood and teenage years. And the first one was that I always had a sense that my body is genetically right, or more like it's genetically healthy. So I'd hear conversations as a child about maybe parents speaking about another child being quote unquote overweight and the parents being blamed for that. And I felt my body matched the ideal of health. So I always felt that my body is just genetically healthy. And I knew that I was lucky that I didn't really have to work for that. But I felt like other people, they should be working towards being genetically healthy, or sorry, being healthy in terms of the right weight that our culture portrays.
Mm-hmm.
And then going into my teenage years, especially like the later teenage years, it became more about worth rather than health. And the first memory, or the first memory that I could still hold on to, I guess, where I started maybe really thinking that my body gave me a lot of worth, was a friend told me that a boy we knew had said to her that she's really skinny, but Emma's tiny. And I kind of took that to mean, oh, your body is really good, but Emma's is better. And there's just no way that that would mean better. But I think from the messages I was surrounded by, I thought that meant my body was more worthy. And it didn't affect my, I don't think it really impacted my life so much, but I definitely hold on to this idea that my BMI should be in the lowest possible range before I was in the quote unquote underweight range.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't any more about health, because if it was about health and I believed that BMI meant health, I wouldn't have minded if my BMI went up. But there was a lot of trying to keep my BMI to that point where it was like only just acceptable. And just being, I think my identity was around being that smallest person as well. So if there was a person, maybe a situation where someone had said, oh, who's the smallest person? They'll, you know, be the one lifted up or the one that goes on top or something.
Mm-hmm.
If that wasn't me, I'd feel a little bit uneasy because that was meant to be my identity.
How tall are you?
Actually, I am exactly average height when I've looked it up for a girl. I'm 163 centimeters.
So that's really like, is that like 5'3",
something like that. I can't actually remember.
Okay. Yeah. So that's so fascinating. And also I actually have multiple clients who I've talked about this with, but this, I think that there is something very different to your point of being identified as the tiny girl versus the skinny girl. Like there's an identity shift there, like you're saying. So I'm curious, like what did that mean to you? What did that word feel like for you at that time?
I think the messages that I'd received just from around everywhere, magazines, shows, everything, made it seem like the smaller the better. So I think the word tiny being, I guess, a word to say that someone is very small or very light, it created that increased sense of self-worth. I don't really even know why that would, but I definitely held on to that word and being the smallest as being part of my identity and giving me more value.
Mm-hmm. What was your relationship with food like as a result of this? Did it correlate at all at that time?
No, so I actually had a very good relationship with food, and especially at the time that I started, I guess, attributing my worth to my body size. But as I said, I genetically had thin privilege, so I didn't need to be restricting my food.
Mm-hmm.
I do remember a little bit later though, having thoughts around feeling hungry is good, but feeling full is bad.
Mm.
And it was never to the stage where I would skip a meal, or I would not go out for a meal with friends, or I would miss out on social events or anything like that. And I think it was also around times that I would say really happy and life was great and exciting. I wouldn't even think about it. But then maybe at times where life was a bit duller or I was just a bit low in mood, that's when I'd more think about that. Mm-hmm. And it was probably more coming up when I was a student, especially first move out of home, and you don't really have much routine. Uni classes are all over the place. My part-time job was all over the place. And I probably just wasn't as organized with food as I could have been. So sometimes maybe meals would get skipped just because I was busy or because I wasn't prepared enough. And I think that's when I had this perception that skipping a meal is good, like eating two meals would be bad. Or feeling hungry is a good thing, whereas if I ate too much and felt full, then that would be a bad thing.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So what was the turning point for you? What's the next chapter in your story in terms of your relationship with your body? It sounds like your relationship with food was shifting slightly in university, but also having the, you know, the thin privilege that you did at the time, it also gave you some, it wasn't as emphasized as a result, it sounds like. So what was the turning point in terms of your relationship with your body?
Yeah, the first time I actually thought that maybe the smallest body size isn't the best place to be was it was about a year where I kept randomly fainting or collapsing. I was getting these symptoms that it was the kind of symptoms that you'd get from having low blood sugar levels. So a diabetic person having a hypo, but I guess I didn't have diabetes. I wasn't taking insulin, but I was getting those symptoms. So I would get really lightheaded and shaky. I couldn't think straight. My vision would go, it would get blurry. And if I'd get this feeling that I needed to eat, and especially needed to eat like sugary foods or carbohydrates. And if I was in a situation where I could get food, I would get food and sit down. It would generally be okay. But it happened several times when I was at work, and I worked in retail and a pharmacy. And I think I just didn't really have the courage to say to someone, I need to go get food right now. Mm-hmm. And I'd end up collapsing and went to the doctor several times. It probably happened about 5 or 6 times that I completely collapsed. And in that experience, going to the doctors, they did all these tests. I don't remember a single doctor ever asking me how I was eating. So I was quite a small person. I was collapsing from symptoms of what sounded like low blood sugar, but that was never tested. And no one said to me, like, how are you eating? Such a simple question. But I wasn't purposely restricting at the time, but I think I just wasn't being very organized with food, and I didn't think it was a problem if I was missing meals. But I remember thinking to myself at that point, maybe I do need to eat more, and maybe trying to keep my BMI to this lowest point is not the healthiest place. Mm-hmm. And even if it goes up a bit, maybe that won't be as worthy, but I'll feel a lot better. Mm-hmm. And I put a bit more focus into just making sure I did have regular meals. And I know there was a bit of a shift in my thinking towards feeling hungry is good and feeling full is bad.
This is all really fascinating. And one of the things that I'm really hearing in your story is this fear of taking up space, almost, it sounds like, and having an identity based around being the smallest person, like the tiniest person, and the safety and not feeling like you had to speak up and ask for a meal break or not necessarily volunteer information at the doctor's office. Am I hearing you correctly? Is that something that you would identify with?
Yeah, you know, I never thought of it like that. But I've always been a fairly quiet and shy person, not necessarily around my close friends and family, but in group situations, I guess at school in a group situation, if it wasn't with my close friends, I wouldn't really speak up. I would be fairly quiet. And yeah, work situations, not as much now, but certainly as a teenager or young adult, I definitely, yeah, I would feel quite intimidated by other people. So that's a really good point.
Well, I think that's, and I'm just kind of curious about that because I think that I don't think we've ever had a conversation like this on the podcast, actually, but I think that this coincides with a lot of body struggles that women face who are more shy. And we could use so many other words other than shy, but just who do have that fear of taking up space or in some way, shape, or form, right? Whether it's verbally, whether it's physically, and how we use our bodies to bypass that, essentially.
Yeah, definitely. And there is this sense, especially for women as well, a lot of the, I guess, media attention, it tells us that we need to be quiet and we need to be hidden away. So it makes sense that we want our body to be able to be hidden away, maybe, or not as obvious.
Yeah, totally. Well, I'm interested in your story too, having thin privilege, which we have talked about on the show, so I don't think we need to give a whole explanation about it, but having the genetic makeup that you did individually that put you in a smaller body by society standards, and also kind of still feeling the need to restrict as well to stay as small as possible in this already small body, genetically speaking. How did you begin to loosen the reins a little bit for yourself? What was the permission that you gave yourself? I know that you mentioned that you gave yourself the opportunity to let your body change and grow a little bit, but what did that look like when you were actually going through it?
Yeah, so I think just sitting down and thinking or deciding that I wanted to feel good and I didn't want to get shaky and risk of collapsing was definitely a turning point to decide that I can take up more space, I can be a bit bigger. But I really think that it came for me at times that yeah, like my life wasn't maybe as exciting, or I felt down as the times that I had more of those thoughts. And I was quite adventurous. I was quite shy, but I was also quite adventurous. So, straight after this point, actually, when I had been collapsing, it was the same year, really soon afterwards, I went on an exchange to Canada. A uni exchange, university exchange, and that was just so exciting. There was so much going on, and I just don't remember thinking at all about restricting food or my body. There was just so much stuff I was enjoying doing with my body. I was getting into new sports like ice skating and ice hockey and some winter activities. And actually, it's really interesting because at the end of that year in Canada, so we'd been through a winter as well, and I'd been enjoying the food in Canada. I'd been working kind of late at night, scorekeeping ice hockey games, and coming home and eating in the middle of the night. Like it didn't, I wasn't concerned about restricting my food or my body. But at the end of that year, I tried on some of my shorts because I was going traveling in Europe after I left, and I realized that my shorts didn't fit me. And I actually just didn't, it didn't faze me. Whereas I'd come from kind of a year before that I'd been trying to keep my BMI at the lowest. But at the times in my life when I was just having so much fun and appreciating my body, it actually didn't faze me at all.
Why do you think it didn't faze you at that point?
I think because I was really happy. I think. And I was also doing, I had a lot of appreciation for what my body could do as well. So I'd got into, I guess, new activities. I started playing ice hockey, which I was loving. I had been doing a lot of like outdoor activities as well, with friends, just hiking and dog sledding and these kind of activities, making the most of being over there. So I think I just had this appreciation for everything I was doing.
Yeah. The focus was outside of your body, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Which is so, like, this is so interesting to me. And I'm so grateful for you sharing this. And I'm so glad to hear that this was your experience. But especially right now, we're recording this when we're 1 year, literally 1 year into lockdown to date. This is the actual, like, date, at least for us in the US. And people are starting to think about coming out of lockdown, and a lot of bodies have changed in lockdown, and just the fear coming up for so many people around, how do I navigate this, and putting so much attention on bodies changing because our focus is so limited right now, because our lives have become so restricted in so many other capacities that our bodies feel like the point of focus for so many things, because there's not much else to think about. And just hearing your story of almost the opposite of this, where your life, you were putting your attention into so many things, and really the equation in terms of where your worthiness around your body fit in was really just aligned with everything else. It wasn't the main focus, it sounds like.
Yeah. And that is a really good point. What we're going through at the moment is, yeah, the complete opposite to, I guess, what I was just describing. I'd gone through in that experience, in that there's been a year where for a lot of people, we haven't even had the opportunity to move our body much. So in any sense, our body could just be feeling a bit sluggish because we just haven't really had that opportunity. And then with all the messages around shaming us for any changes that we've had in our body, which is pretty normal when we're doing, we had a very different year and doing completely different things. And the stress that we've been experiencing, for a lot of us, we've had a lot less outside focus, as you were saying. It's been very, I guess, lockdowns and in our house, not chance to see friends or do new activities. So the focus, it does go on our body when there's not much around. And then when we're faced with this possible, this reality of having to get back out into the world, maybe having to go into the office again soon, it's really difficult.
Yeah, it absolutely. Well, and now that we're talking about this, I'm curious in your personal story too, because you're a dietitian, correct?
Yes, that's right.
So going through university and studying that, I imagine that your entire focus was on that degree and probably not much else, right?
Yeah. Do you mean while I was studying?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. So when I was in Canada, I was studying health sciences, majoring in nutrition, but it wasn't so intense at that time in the undergrad. But later than that, back in Australia, I was studying the Masters of Dietetics, and yeah, it was definitely a very intense course.
Was your diet? What was that app? Sorry.
Do you mean the focus was largely on bodies and what we were eating during the course?
I see this so often too, just disordered eating and eating disorders in college specifically, because kind of like we're saying within lockdown right now, when our lives are not filled with a variety of things and it's more restrictive in what we're putting our attention into, that really ups the emphasis on the things that we're putting our attention to. And so for a lot of people in college who are going through disordered eating, and specifically in dietetics nutrition programs, it's all consuming, the information that you're trying to get a degree with, and then also maintaining health essentially and your body. And those are kind of like, it's very black and white for so many people. Do you feel like it was that way for you at all?
Yeah, definitely. And the degree is so focused on weight as well. So I really liked for me going into dietetics, I was actually more interested in the health and the clinical side of it. So I found that all very interesting, but in so many clinical situations, they managed to bring weight into the conversation. And to be honest, going through university, I wasn't so aware of my privileges and I wasn't aware of the sociocultural, barriers around body diversity.
Mm.
But to be a larger bodied person studying this degree would be very, very difficult, very stigmatizing.
Mm.
And yeah, thinking back to the degree, it's very, I guess when you Google like an image of a dietitian, it is fairly accurate in what the majority of dietitians do look like. And I always thought that we looked like that in my degree because we were healthy. I knew that I genetically had that body type, but I also just thought, well, we're healthy people. But looking back now, the course just isn't very welcoming for people that don't fit that stereotype.
Yeah, it sounds like there's a lot of morality there as well too, like we're doing it the right way.
Definitely, yeah.
So how did you find intuitive eating? I was going to ask how you started healing your relationship with food and your body, but how did you even learn about intuitive eating in the first place?
Yeah, so good question. I guess the way that I was taught at uni, it never completely felt right to me, the things that we were told to tell people. So I actually just really disliked working in outpatients or community settings or clinics because I felt like I wasn't good at that. So I stuck to working on the hospital wards where I was working with clinical conditions, but I would have to do some outpatient clinics and I'd get people I'd see for chronic disease or quote unquote weight management. And I thought I wasn't good at it because I didn't feel comfortable telling people the information we were told to tell people. So that's things like going through portion sizes or calorie counting, showing them, you know, different representations of sizes or how much they should be eating or use a teaspoon of oil only. And all these little rules that it was something that I didn't do myself.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely took on some diet culture food rules or mm-hmm. food thoughts, but I didn't have those extreme behaviors. And I felt, well, if I'm not doing it myself and I'm fine, like why does someone else have to do that? And the other side of it was when I'd work with those patients, they would often open up about these much, much deeper issues. And they'd heard many times before that, you know, they should eat more vegetables or whatever it was. Like that just didn't feel like the issue. And telling them what to eat just didn't seem like it would help. But I didn't know what would help. And I thought I was wrong because that's what we were told at uni. And that's what I thought the science said. So I just thought I was wrong. So for a long time, I shied away from it. Until a point where I just thought, this isn't right. There has to be something else. I want to start a non-diet practice. Mm. But my idea at the time was non-diet for weight loss, which looking back now, I'm like, oh, but.
Oh, I did that too. I can totally relate to that.
I mean, we had the right intentions. We just hadn't had the opportunity to learn.
Mm-hmm.
But I do give myself credit because I knew that there was more to learn and I knew that I wanted to be able to help people the best I could. So I started just looking up stuff. I did some mindful eating courses and it was good, but there was just still something missing. I joined a Facebook group, which is like a non-diet professionals Facebook group here in the UK. And through that, people started talking about intuitive eating. I wasn't completely I thought it was very interesting, the concept of it, but I was still a bit hesitant with the whole, you know, not focusing on weight loss part of it. Then someone posted a link to a short online training that was on weight stigma. And doing that is actually where I thought, yeah, I've got to change. Because there's all these conditions and diseases that I still believed we had to, weight loss should be the answer. Like, I still believe that we had to lose weight to treat these conditions, say like diabetes. And then doing the weight stigma training, I realized that actually weight stigma can, independently of weight, actually worsen these conditions, worsen like our blood markers for like blood sugar levels and our stress markers. And that is where I thought, well, if we're just promoting weight loss, but then weight loss is worsening weight stigma, and then that can also worsen someone's medical condition.
Emma,
that was a turning point.
Can you explain what weight stigma is in just in your own words? It doesn't have to be a textbook definition, but I'd love for you to just conceptualize this for everybody who's listening.
Yeah, so weight stigma is the discrimination that people in larger bodies face.
Mm-hmm.
So that's discrimination that comes from all over our culture, really. So discrimination in like workplaces, discrimination in the way they're treated, discrimination in spaces being accessible. And weight stigma can be, we can have, yeah. Sorry, I'm having a blank.
No, it's a loaded question. And also those are really great examples. I mean, it's kind of everywhere. It's like this internal bias against people in larger bodies based on what we're taught in society and generationally. And, you know, and also I'm just hearing your story too. And I'm thinking like, well, of course it's so hard to let go of the idea of weight loss. You went to school for like, that is a deep belief, it sounds like, that was formed for you. Like, you went to school being taught that weight loss is the answer, like this equals health. And it sounds very dissonant in your story, actually intuitively knowing like, hey, this something isn't right about this, but I'm not really sure what the answer is. And then having some evidence to back up that intuition as well too.
Yeah, definitely. And I think the part that makes it really hard is dietetics is a science-based course, and we're constantly told it's evidence-based. So then when something doesn't feel right, you're thinking in your head, but it's evidence-based. And then when I was faced with evidence showing that why that can actually be harmful, that I guess it helped me to just feel more comfortable in being able to explore another way, because it wasn't just some random thought. It was actually, there was evidence behind it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, how do you decipher that now, being a non-diet dietitian in the intuitive eating space who has gone through years of education in one realm where you are getting that evidence-based curriculum around the promotion of weight loss and that equating to health and all of these things? What are some ways that you look at that now and can debunk that professionally speaking? Or where do you feel like there's loopholes in the evidence that professors are teaching dietetic students or nutrition students in any way?
Yeah, so probably the main part of it is that there's actually no cause. So there's no research that shows weight causes a disease.
Mm-hmm.
It's all correlation. But it's taught to us and it's shown to us, even if we're not going to uni studying this, it's just shown to us everywhere through the media that weight causes these diseases. And it's taught to us at uni as if it causes a disease. But the research doesn't show that. It just shows that within a population of higher weight people, there might be a higher percentage of these particular diseases, but that's correlation. That doesn't show what comes first. And it also doesn't show what's in the middle. So if we think about it, we've got weight on one side, health on the other side, but in the middle, we've got all these different things. We've got environmental factors that are completely out of our control. We've got behaviors that are maybe partly within our control. We've got weight stigma. We've got things like fruit and vegetable intake and movement and all these things that are actually not related to weight at all. Or they exist independently of weight. But a lot of these factors might be more common in a high weight population. Mm-hmm. So for example, like a low socioeconomic status is more common in a high weight population. It's also commonly associated with poorer health. So we've got this in the middle of the link between weight and health, but all of those middle factors are just erased or not presented to us or not even maybe explored in the research. And it's presented as if it's a causal effect, but it's actually just a correlation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, without taking genetics into account either.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's probably the big
Well, no, I think that everything that you said is so spot on. I literally just thought of that as well, too, as you're sharing all of this. But that's huge. Genetics is a massive part. I think it's 75% of our body weight and just the size and the shape of our body is based on genetics alone. I don't know if that percentage has shifted at all as more research has come out, but that's the last number that I can remember. But I'm curious for you, being in this space now, practicing intuitive eating and being a non-diet dietitian, I know that one of the things that you're really passionate about is the lack of diversity in the intuitive eating space. So share a little bit more about that if you're open to it. I have some thoughts on this too, and I would love to just jam on this for a moment. So
yeah, of course.
Yeah.
So you mean within like the health at every size and intuitive eating space, is that what you mean?
Yeah, but yes, let's start there because I think that we can take this a few different directions, but yes.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, do you know, I remember when I was starting to learn about health at every size and which is an important aspect of intuitive eating, and reading an article that health at every size isn't representative of all bodies. And I guess that was maybe a negative side of that, and doing some thinking around that of why that maybe why it isn't representative. But when we look at the population of people who are practicing intuitive eating and health at every size, it's largely come from, I guess, people with a background of nutrition and dietetics. They're the people that are, I guess, the primary people that are practicing that approach. And we look at the population of nutrition and dietetics students and nutritionists and dietitians, it is a thin population. So the people that are going into, I guess initially at least, going into finding health at every size and intuitive eating, they're probably going to be a high percentage of people in thinner bodies, and that makes the space not so representative.
Mm-hmm.
We need more diversity within dietetics, within nutrition, for sure, and that will help to diversify the space in general. But I think it comes from so far back. Like, we've got this kind of movement that we're trying to be really inclusive and diverse, but then the people going into that are coming from places that aren't very open to diversity. And then it goes even further back than that with our culture making people feel that they're not welcome in a space. So like welcome to go into being a nutritionist or a dietitian because their body's not right.
Mm-hmm.
What's your thoughts around?
Yeah, well, I think I am in agreement with everything that you're saying right now. And I also think that one of the things that is really interesting about this conversation is the disordered eating that goes on in these programs and eating disorders, just like flat out eating disorders that so many dietetic students and nutrition students experience, that just really flies under the radar because healthy eating in an unhealthy way is so normalized. And especially in programs like this, where it's almost this competitive nature around premier health and moral hierarchy around foods that you're eating and body size and all of these just like boxes to check off around health that we've been indoctrinated into essentially as a culture. And I think that has a severe impact in terms of not only the lack of diversity in the intuitive eating space, but also some of the rigidity that's brought into the intuitive eating space as well, too. Just like we were saying before, intuitive eating, there are so many things to unlearn. Like every single person who comes into this work, we've all got our bags to unpack. We've all got things to unlearn. And so much of that is so deeply ingrained into our values, into our self-worth, into our beliefs, into our, just how we view health in general. And I think that a lot of that shows up in how we educate around intuitive eating. And it gets tricky. I'll look at people doing this work and I'm just thinking like, God, that is like, I'm so glad you're doing this work, but that's still so like rigid and rules-based and just very, very, not intuitive, but intuitive at the same time. Does that make sense? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I think it's hard to let go of those rules. So a lot of people go into dietetics or nutrition with this idea that, well, I'm going to learn how to eat perfectly. And then we're told during the course, this is how you eat perfectly. And then we're told to just tell people what to eat. We're not taught to like explore and to help them explore what feels best for them to eat. We're taught to tell them what to eat and not to trust that someone can work it out for themselves. So then when you go into intuitive eating, it's actually really difficult to let go of just giving someone rules.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've got a lot more comfortable with it now, but certainly when I started out, I would be biting my tongue so much.
Mm-hmm.
Someone would say like, oh, it could even just be, you know, a general talking about different things going their food. And they'll say like, oh, I often eat when I'm watching TV. And I just want to jump in and be like, well, how about we don't eat while you're watching TV? But it was like, no, like they surely know that, or they can work out for themselves whether they do feel comfortable eating watching TV or whether they enjoy food better if they're not. Like there's actually no right or wrong, but we're taught to tell people these things.
Mm-hmm.
So it is really difficult to let go. When you do start practicing intuitive eating, it's so hard to let go of giving people even what doesn't maybe feel like a rule so much, but it still kind of is if you're telling them.
Mm-hmm. Well, how did you do that for yourself? Because I think that, you know, as we grow individually, our the information that we relay to everybody else grows. And so what were some of the challenges that you faced in letting go of some of those rules, and how did you navigate that for yourself?
Yeah. In terms of, I think the thing that was the most helpful for me was unpacking my own beliefs about bodies. And realizing that the only reason I hadn't been severely impacted in my life, well, I believe that the main reason I hadn't been severely impacted in my life was because my body did fit the ideal. And I didn't think that I had strong beliefs about bodies. I didn't think I had any fat phobia, but unpacking that, I did. I mean, I lived in this culture. I was surrounded by these messages. I thought that I was more worthy if I kept my body small. And to do that, the most helpful thing was hearing stories from people in all different bodies. Mm-hmm. So reading different books from different people, exploring body diversity, podcasts, just listening to people's stories with patients or clients I was seeing at the time, just asking them more questions around their bodies. And also my social media as well, like around the time I found intuitive eating, I started adding all these different accounts and just seeing different bodies on my social media doing normal things that really gave me, I think, so differently about bodies, and I didn't even know I had these biases. And now, yeah, my sense of what someone's body can do, I don't think that I would ever assume what someone's body can do now, whereas before I would have, maybe it was more subconsciously, but I would have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's almost that habituation process with exposure therapy, you know, and the opposite is true for that as well too. We've been habituated into a culture that promotes one very standard size body and equates that to health. And if that's what we're seeing every single day through the messages that we're receiving through the advertising, marketing, and just, you know, the people that we have in our lives perhaps, and we're not giving ourselves the exposure to different diverse bodies, then of course we are going to form a belief around that. That makes complete sense psychologically, but the opposite is true for that as well too, you know? And I think that's so valuable. What you're sharing, just going through that process of normalizing that for yourself and habituating it so that when you did see a body that looked different from yours, where in the past you might've had a reaction in some way or a belief come up, you know, now it sounds like you're at the point where you can really just receive it without feeling triggered necessarily and just accept that, yes, that's another body and they're capable of the same things that I am in their own lived experience and in that sense as well too.
Yeah, definitely. And I think just the way we even view bodies, like before, from the messages around, there's this sense that a smaller body is more beautiful or something. And now when we start normalizing all body sizes, that just seems ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's at the stage now when I see maybe media or campaigns or whatever that just have one body size or promoting really thin body sizes, it just makes me, that I notice that so much more than I would have before. I probably would have, that would have just been normal.
Mm-hmm.
Now I notice it and it just makes me annoyed.
Mm-hmm.
But also I just don't think that there's no one body type that's more beautiful than another. It is just what we're told to believe. That's what we're surrounded by since we're babies, really. And it's so powerful when we do, as you said, habituate to diversity. It takes away these beliefs that we have, and it's really empowering.
It is. It absolutely is. So I'm curious on your professional and also personal take on changing the current trajectory and also just the current culture of intuitive eating counselors and dietitians and nutritionists and just this space. From your own experience as somebody who is in an able body, has thin privilege, you're white, you know have like socioeconomic privilege and all of these things, from your viewpoint, what can we do to begin creating this change and really create more diversity in this space?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think there's different levels to look at. Certainly as a culture, we need to change the messaging around, but it's actually really difficult because the messages around at the moment, especially especially the last year during the pandemic. And it just happened again this week, actually, on the start of this week, another weight loss campaign was announced in the UK. And that's kind of what we've been surrounded by the whole time, and all this blame around bodies. But on a cultural level, that is what we need to change. We need to shift the conversation from weight. All these campaigns are meant to be about health, they're always focused on weight loss. We need to change that to be focused on health and well-being and our mental health, supporting each other and being kind. And obviously we can do that to some extent, but I think it is a challenge at the moment when coming from the government messages, it's all around body shaming and we should all be losing weight. The Prime Minister had recorded a video saying, I gave up chocolate and started exercising and now I've lost weight. Mm. And that kind of messaging is really dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
Especially telling a whole nation what they should do based on your short-term experience. But saying that on like a smaller, even on an individual level, when we work on our own confidence and beliefs around our body, that's really powerful to being able to stand up to the messages around us. And it's also really powerful in how we can stand, or how we can influence those around us, especially someone with children, how they can influence their children's beliefs, and just how we can show up with our friends as well when they're having, maybe bringing up weight loss in conversations, or bringing up these, you know, health campaigns, weight loss campaigns in conversations. I think if we have that really strong confidence in ourselves, it helps us to bring that to the people around us as well.
Mm. I love that you just said that. I'm a big believer in that as well too. Just that inner confidence and that inner self-worth, and that inner self-trust. I mean, that's really where change starts, right? Mm-hmm. Like if we don't have that, it's like we're trying to do this on really shaky ground. And these are hard conversations. Like these are really, they're new conversations for a lot of people. And especially whether it's setting a boundary, whether it's expressing an emotional need, whether it is, just sharing your viewpoint on some of the things that we're talking about right now. If you don't have that inner confidence for yourself around how you feel about yourself in this respect, it is so deeply triggering to do that with other people, even your own family and friends, close family and friends. And so I think that's such a great point that you just made.
Yeah, definitely. It can make such a big difference to how we take on the messages as well.
Totally.
Yeah. And I hope that things start to change, but at the moment we are surrounded by these really triggering messages.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, finding that inner confidence, knowing that, yeah, that's being said, but that's a public health campaign. And with any public health campaign, it's not targeted to every single person. So just having that confidence to know that, okay, that's being said, but I don't need to take that on because I know that that's not the right information mm-hmm. for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that emotional boundary, that mental boundary of what's mine and what's theirs.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, from a cultural standpoint and just from like a very personal standpoint as well too. I think that's super important. I'm curious in terms of your own experience with COVID right now and just seeing these messages, and I'm sure, you know, being human and still, well, I don't know. Do you ever get triggered anymore? Like what does that look like for you these days? What would trigger you at this point?
Yeah, I don't get personally triggered. I know I do have the privilege that I'm not in a body that they're stigmatizing and shaming. So I don't get personally triggered in that way. But because I've because I'm doing this work and I know the science around it and I'm working with people who do get triggered by it, I get really frustrated and angry. And it's a completely different way to someone who is struggling, because they're taking that on personally. Whereas for me, it's just this anger at the culture. And how can we still, I mean, how can it still be considered normal to be shaming people, be discriminating people, and stereotyping people as well, just based on something like their body size? And how are we not connecting that we don't need to focus on weight loss, which doesn't work? And even, I mean, the research is such a strong body of research showing that. And even if we're not going to look at that, it's just kind of obvious it's not working. And how have we not shifted our point now? How have we not just shifted it to be about health? There's all these mental health campaigns as well, but then we still focus on weight loss. Like, how are we not thinking about all this other side of it? And yeah, I do get triggered and I do get angry, because I know that that's not right and I know that it's harming people. And in a lot of ways, it would just be easier to stay in diet culture and be a dietitian who's helping people lose weight. But it's just, once you know, once you learn this information, that you just can't. Like, physically I couldn't, I wouldn't want to, but it is a tough fight, and it is something that you're kind of fighting against it all, but you're like, you know, it's right.
Oh my God. I'm like having a personal flashback right now, because not too long ago I was crying to one of my mentors, just saying like, it would be so much easier to promote weight loss, but I can never do that. Like, it's just, it goes against everything that I stand for and believe in. And I just, you know, I cannot do that. And, I totally feel you. It was an emotional day. Oh my God. Well, I absolutely love this conversation, and I really appreciate you sharing your truth and just taking the time and everything that you had to say. I think that this is really important. So thank you so much. And where can everybody connect with you and get to know you more?
Yeah. So I am on Instagram. It's Food Life Freedom. So it's food.life.freedom. Also have a Facebook page, which is Food Life Freedom without the dots in it. And my website as well is foodlifefreedom.com.
Awesome. Very consistent. I love it.
Very consistent.
Well, thank you, Emma, so much. And I just appreciate you and everything that you shared today.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's been a really great conversation.
That's our show. Thank you to our producer, Stephanie Olea, our show manager, Shayla Anderson, and our incredible guest. If you want to stay connected and learn more about our guest today, click the show notes of this episode. And if this conversation resonated with you, please share it with a friend or leave a review so that we can continue to destigmatize these important conversations around our relationship with food and body, and spread inspiration to more women. One last thing, please don't forget to hit subscribe so that you can save time and stay on top of each new episode every week. I'm sending you so much love, confidence, and strength. Talk to you soon.